And this has led to probably one of the more unexpected consequences of the ICC's involvement in African countries, which is just a resurgence of Pan-African solidarity. I'm not going to talk about this in any detail, but this is, the Bashir case has really been a lightning rod for Pan-African solidarity. They've come out with resolutions repeatedly supporting Bashir and denouncing, essentially, the International Criminal Court. The greater question that I want to look at very briefly is how these criticisms of the ICC, sort of how the language of state sovereignty and neocolonialism have impacted the ICC's broader mission, which includes not just ending impunity, but also promoting human rights norms and rule of law standards. So the ICC's very existence is predicated on a set of assumptions about the institution's shorter and longer term benefits. Supporters of the ICC make broad and aspirational claims about the institution's presumed deterrent effect. It is argued that convictions of high-ranking perpetrators will strengthen accountability for the gravest crimes, demonstrate that no one is above the law, and even promote an international rule of law. The problem is that there's almost no empirical evidence to support any of these claims, whether the ICC is actually fostering a culture of respect for human rights. Bringing an end to impunity or helping peace building is difficult to gauge and is contested in the literature. What is clear, however, is that the controversy surrounding the ICC's unenforced arrest warrants are sending the wrong signal to many Africans. African governments have been thumbing their noses at the international community for several years now, leaving the ICC to look hopelessly impotent in many situations. In the DRC, for example, the ICC has been used as a symbol to stall important justice initiatives. In Sudan, it's not entirely clear that the ICC indictments have helped to promote peace. And this year, the big test case for the ICC is what will happen in Kenya with elections coming up later this year. The prosecutor has decided to proceed with this case against four Kenyan politicians. It remains to be seen whether this will have any beneficial effect on the situation, on the human rights situation in Kenya. So I'm just going to say that I think there's little doubt that the mood across Africa regarding the ICC has changed considerably since 2002. And to some extent, this should not come as a surprise. The court went from being an abstract human rights endeavor to a practical reality, and in the process, it has thrown up many unanticipated questions about politics and justice. The concept of state sovereignty has experienced a surprising resurgence in the vocabulary of African critics of the court. There's also been a surge in Pan-African solidarity, which shouldn't be mistaken for African unanimity, but it is solidarity nonetheless. On the whole, I'd say that neocolonialism is still the one issue which is misunderstood and underestimated in the literature. There's a clear tendency to play down the importance of neocolonialism and instead to point to alternative explanations of the ICC's involvement in only Africa. And the classic one is, the ICC is in Africa because that's where all the crimes are being committed. I mean, this is just very simplistic. The problem with this narrative, I would argue, is that it focuses on intent. The question here isn't whether the prosecutor is intentionally targeting just African countries for some evil motive, but rather whether the whole ICC system is constructed in a way that perpetuates or exacerbates the legacies of political, economic, or legal colonialism. And there's ample evidence to suggest that this is the direction in which the ICC has been heading. It would be misguided, I think, to dismiss African complaints as out of hand. Just one last sentence. I think it's paradoxical, really, that the ICC, which was supposed to usher in a new chapter in the quest for universal human rights, is being used as an argument against human rights initiatives. Of course, some criticisms of the ICC are being deployed strategically as a symbol of broad, but I would also argue that the symbolic use of the court's image, negative image, in Africa, interesting in and of itself and deserves further study. Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
Sorry, go ahead.
Our second speaker is Matthew Shannon, and I will, I forgot to mention the title of your paper. Matthew will be speaking on competing visions of modernity around the international community and human rights during the 1970s.
All right, thanks. And I just want to thank, you know, Keith and Rachel and everybody else who helped organize this, because it was quite a feat and I really enjoyed it. And thanks, Patrick. That was a great talk. If I can follow it up strong. Just a quick note before I begin the talk of kind of what this presentation is part of. It's part of a larger dissertation, and the human rights focus is really just one chapter. So that's the chapter that I'm going to be talking about today, but the dissertation is on more generally U.S. student exchange programs with Iran from the early 50s until the revolution in the late 1970s. So, you know, you could argue, I don't in the dissertation, but that these student exchange programs were in some ways successful, that just by sheer numbers alone, the numbers rose from 500, around 500 in 1950, to more than 50,000 in 1979. Iran had more students in the U.S. by the end of the 1970s than any other country, more international students. You know, some of these students went back and worked in Iran's plan organization. Some became prime minister. Some joined, you know, many went into Iran's military, and this was kind of all what, you know, Washington would have hoped to accomplish through these student exchange programs. But I argue that it created, these exchange programs created more friction than harmony in the U.S.-Iran relationship. One of the manifestations of this friction was this internationalist coalition of Americans and Iranian students in the U.S. that by the 1960s went through great lengths to contest the Pahlavi regime in Iran and also the larger U.S.-Iran relationship internationally. And as far as human rights goes, the student movement in the U.S. and their allies in the U.S. did not always, this has kind of come up throughout the day, so I figured I should probably address it, but they didn't always articulate their opposition to the U.S.-Iran relationship or the Pahlavi regime through the language of human rights.